There's a somewhat strange and somewhat familiar face in the back there. I believe Abel's back there, right? Stand up and say hi at least, Abel. Many of you guys don't know Aaron's older brother, Abel. It's been a while since we saw them because they've been in California too. But I've actually never met Katie sitting next to him, but I look forward to doing that. So that's Abel, just so you know. Let's go to Proverbs here tonight. Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 29. Proverbs 29. We got down through verse 10 last time, so we'll begin with verse 11. And in verse 11, the Bible begins, "A fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it in till afterwards." There's an old saying that says, the wise speak because they have something to say, fools speak because they have to say something. I've known a few like that. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. "And a fool uttereth all his mind." You probably have known somebody of your present or past acquaintance that has to make a comment or has to say something about just about everything. And I do recall this verse fairly often, "A fool uttereth all his mind." There is something to be said for, even if you have the right answer sometimes, even if you think you have something to put in, sometimes it's wise to keep it in till afterward. Look in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Go down to verse 3. "For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by multitude of words." That's an interesting thing. A fool's voice is known by multitude of words. Yep. What is this guy? What is this lady? A fool's voice is known by a multitude of words. Amen? Look in Ecclesiastes chapter 10. If you say amen, that's not a multitude of words. That's just one, and that's fine. That's fine. Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Go down to verse 14. Think of our present election season and how it seems that these guys get up and use this constant stream of cliches and things that nobody even knows what it means anymore. And sometimes what you're looking at, you're listening to two men that are fools talking, right? Ecclesiastes 10:14. "A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be after him. Who can tell him? But a fool also is full of words." Talk. Look in just a few more places here. Proverbs 17:27. It is not a bad thing, folks, even if you have something to put in. It's not a bad thing to hang back and to not say anything. Do you know that? It's not a bad thing to cultivate a spirit where you don't always have to have the final words. Right? Proverbs chapter 17 and go down to verse... I lost my place, my note. Get it here in just a second. 17:27. "He that hath knowledge spareth his words." Now that's a different take on it. It's not just that a fool can't seem to shut his mouth, but says there that he that hath knowledge spareth his words, and a man of understanding is of an excellent spirit. That excellent spirit is connected with the first part of the sentence. He that hath knowledge spareth his words. It is worthwhile to cultivate a spirit where you don't always have to put in your two bits. It really is. It's not to say that talking is wrong. It's not to say that putting something in is wrong. I encourage that in many cases. But Proverbs 10. Proverbs chapter 10. Proverbs 10, 29. That would be 19. I'm sorry. In the multitude of words, there wanteth not sin. Now, you know, this it has not escaped my attention that I'm standing here talking about a multitude of words. In the meantime, I pretty much make my living standing up here yapping at you guys, and nobody says much of anything. I just stand up here and preach, right? Well, the Bible does say the foolishness of preaching, right? The foolishness of preaching is the power. God ordained the foolishness of preaching, all right? So, there's a place where it's sanctified, but there's also a place where, and everybody here knows somebody who just yaps, and can never seem to just quietly sit to the side and not desire the spotlight, right? Look in Proverbs 29:20, the final comment on this verse. Okay, a fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it in till afterward. Well, Proverbs 29:20, seest thou a man that is hasty in his words? There is more hope of a fool than of him. Every one of us here have regretted at times all the talking that we've done. I suppose, as a young man, I have regrets for some things that I said and the fool that I made of myself, right? Most of you have been down that road at one point or another. Back to Proverbs 29, verse 11. A fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it in till afterward. If a ruler hearken to lies, all his servants are wicked. That sounds kind of strange, doesn't it? If a ruler hearken to lies, all his servants are wicked. On the one hand, you could view that from, if the ruler hearkens to lies, then eventually, since he's the leader, everybody else follows suit. And eventually they become wicked as well because he's the leader, right? On the other hand, you can view it from the perspective that maybe the servants have a role in this. If the ruler hearken to lies, and there should be some of the servants that realize he's being lied to and is making a mistake. Meanwhile, they don't speak up and say anything. I have no desire to be president whatsoever, okay? Or governor or anything like that. But if I were president or governor, I think I would more than anything else want to make sure I was surrounded by somebody that could cut through when I'm being lied to and when I'm not being lied to and would tell me if they thought I was being lied to. Right? I hope that's, you know, what you would do. I'm not so sure that that's a present state of affairs as things go now. I think that in our current season, I'm not going to tell you who to vote for or if to vote or whatever. I just think that there are times that these guys actually have believed a lie. They live in a facade, fake world that's reared up of straw dummies and straw men. I really don't think they live in the real world. Barack Obama has never carried a shovel, used a shovel in his life. I think to be president, everybody should have to swing an axe for a while. I think to be president, you should have to know what to do with a shovel if somebody puts it in your hand. And all too often we've had, you know, men in positions like that that have never done anything in their lives, right? Now, I'm not going to get off on all that, but if a ruler hearkened to lies, all his servants are wicked, okay? I'll give you an example of this. The Lord held somebody accountable like this in 1 Samuel. Chapter 12, 1 Samuel 12. And again, part of this, from one end, is if the ruler hearkened to lies, then there's going to be a bunch of people follow him. so his servants in the end become wicked. But on the other hand, he should have servants around him that would say, hey, you're being lied to about this, right? 1 Samuel chapter 12, notice verse 14. This is Israel being held accountable by Samuel for having required of themselves a king. They now have Saul, and now Samuel is letting them know just what manner of king they've gotten for themselves. It's interesting how this goes. Verse 13. Now therefore, behold, the king whom ye have chosen, and whom ye have desired, and behold, the Lord hath set a king over you. If ye will fear the Lord, and serve him, and obey his voice, and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then shall both ye and also the king that reigneth over you continue following the Lord your God. If you fear the Lord and do right, then both you and your king will be okay. Now look further down here. Go down to Proverbs, 1 Samuel 12. Go down to verse 25, if you would. And Samuel is again still preaching to these folks. In fact, he convinces them of how wrong this decision has been to get a king because of the thunder and the rain that comes down. Verse 19. All the people said to Samuel, pray for thy servants unto the Lord thy God, that we die not, for we have added unto all our sins this evil to ask us a king. See, they ask a king when the Lord said, the Lord is your king. And they ask for a king. Well, verse 20. Samuel said unto the people, fear not. Ye have done all this wickedness, yet turn not aside. This is a great verse, for after you have messed up and have crossed the line and even offended God, Samuel the prophet's answer is, fear not, ye have done all this wickedness, you did wrong, yet turn not aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. In other words, the answer for you after having done wrong is what? To do right. There's just nothing that substitutes for doing right. Even after you've fallen flat on your face and done wrong, get up and do right. Back to verse 21. And turn ye not aside, for then should ye go after vain things, which cannot profit nor deliver, for they are vain. For the Lord will not forsake His people for His great name's sake. Ever think about that? Ever think about the fact that the Lord... This is Israel. You're a Christian. It's different. I know that. Ever think about the fact that the Lord's not going to desert you, not because you're you and you're so special. He's not going to desert you for His name's sake. It's not about you. It's about Him. But it's still a great promise for me in that I don't want to be deserted. Right? Back to verse 22. Because it hath pleased the Lord to make you His people. Moreover, as for me, God forbid that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you, but I will teach you the good and the right way. Only, fear the Lord, serve Him in truth with all your heart, for consider how great things He hath done for you. But if ye shall still do wickedly, ye shall be consumed, both ye and your king. Now, this is written to the people of Israel. This is written not necessarily to their king, but to them. Again, indicating that they have their own responsibility. Yes, they have a bad king now, but they have their own responsibility for whether they will continue and proceed as they should or whether or not the Lord will judge them. And so, think about that, because yet a third perspective on this verse says there... If a ruler hearken to lies, all his servants are wicked. I know you've heard this preached before. I think there's an element of truth to it. The reason we have the leadership in our country that we do is because we voted them in. I mean, the fact of the matter is, the American people, no matter what the politicians say, no matter what the right-wing conservatives say, and I'm pretty right-wing, but... The American people don't deserve anybody better. They have not done right. Abortions are going through the roof. The Sodomite agenda is gaining momentum as we sit here and speak. Okay? We're openly allowing an invasion by a religious outfit that is going to destroy us in time. Everybody should know they're going to try to take over once they get the population, right? So, the real question is, yes, I'm grieved in heart because President Obama might get a second term. But the fact of the matter is, I'm surrounded, not tonight, I hope, but I'm surrounded by people that voted for him and don't see anything wrong with what he's doing. They think he's doing a great job. Same thing with Clinton back in the bad old days where he was trying to define is in some other way than is. Right? I mean, the American people were not indignant enough to genuinely throw him out. Why? Because their sins. So, folks, if a ruler hearkened to lies, all his servants are wicked. The fact of the matter is, I've always tried to do the right thing and vote for the right guy as much as possible and all that. But the reason, again, that somebody is in office is because the people voted him in. You ask for it, you got it. Have it your way. Burger King. I dated myself, didn't I? Sorry about that. It's been a while since that was on, I think. Verse 12, if a ruler hearken to lies, all his servants are wicked. The poor and the deceitful man meet together. The Lord lighteneth both their eyes. Kind of funny, the poor and the deceitful, you'd think it would say the poor and the rich, or the trustworthy and the deceitful, or whatever. But it says the poor and the deceitful man meet together. The Lord lighteneth both their eyes. In other words, both for the poor and the deceitful, everybody gets light from the Lord. And the Lord maybe open their eyes about each other or about themselves. But if the poor and the deceitful man meet together, the Lord lighteneth both their eyes. Verse 14. The king that faithfully judgeth the poor, his throne shall be established forever. Notice the one key word there, the king that faithfully judgeth the poor. Okay? A king is supposed to judge right. Okay? That king needs good judgment. Yes, he needs to judge the poor. But sometimes the poor are poor for a reason. We've gone over that many times. The point is that the king must faithfully judge the poor. And again, not to camp out on it and make this, you know, a whole political stump speech tonight or anything like that. I think we now come to a day, folks, where our presidents and governors very seldom judge much that's right about anything. When you, folks, it's not just liberals that are going for the Sodomite agenda. There are conservative Republicans that think it's fine. They do. Now, something is not right. Somebody has a defiled conscience. And if you have a defiled conscience, then you don't judge right. You don't think right. Right? You have a, you know, this whole thing where all we've heard for all these years is that, you know, the Republicans are for the rich and the Democrats are for the poor and all that kind of stuff. Folks, you do realize that when you tax the stink out of rich people, you're taxing people that have the money to create jobs. And if you do that, like, I'm not mad at anybody because they're rich, okay? I'm happy to have somebody get richer and richer. Presumably, they're going to want to make more money. That means they're going to build more buildings, expand their corporations. And yes, I think corporations are good. They're going to expand their corporations and they're going to have more jobs. They're job creators. My question is, this has been preached for a very long time. Economists know it. Ronald Reagan preached it all the way back then. But there's an entire section of our country that doesn't understand that it takes money to make money if we're talking about a corporate job-making level. Why would you want to strangle rich people, corporate leaders, If you as a poor or middle class person wanted a job this guy creates, you're cutting off the very limb you're sitting on. Now, why is that so hard to get? It shouldn't be if you judge right. Right? If you judge right. Tell me when you've been hired and have had a good job that was created by a poor man. He don't have money to pay you. Right? Well, what sense does this make? Down in verse 14, the king that faithfully judgeth the poor, yes, the poor, but again, some of those poor have to be turned away because they're poor for a reason. It's their fault. That king is to judge the poor. His throne shall be established forever. Verse 15, the rod and reproof give wisdom. I showed you this verse last week, and the NIV changed something significant here. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. I think the NIV changes that, but a child who gets his own way. Now, a child getting his own way all the time will spoil the child. That's true, but that's not what it says. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. Increasingly, you have kids basically rearing themselves. That always turns into a disaster. And the reason why is because a kid needs a mother and a father, and a kid needs a rod and reproof. Now, there's another verse down here, verse 17. Correct thy son, he shall give thee rest, yea, he shall give delight unto thy soul. So three words there in those two verses. Rod, reproof, correct. Those three things are virtual abominations these days. Rod, that's against the law now in Delaware. Mentioned that on Sunday, right? The rod is a very controversial subject. Your kids need a spanking. I don't know. I ain't saying they need a beating. You don't have to beat them black and blue. We're not talking about it. We're talking about a moderate spanking that changes their attitude about what they're going to do. Okay? That's what little buttocks are for. I mean, they're little fatty, muscly tissues, and those are real good for whacking somebody on their behind. And no internal organs are damaged whatsoever by a light little rod that provides a little sting. So the kid realizes he's going to have to mind his daddy or get some more where that came from. Right? A rod and reproof give wisdom. Verse 17, correct thy son. You now live in a day where our schools don't believe in red ink anymore. In fact, I heard something the other day that there were teachers now that don't use red ink because now red ink means that they're hurting the child's self-image because red for a long time has been, you know, connected with being wrong. Well, you know what? When you can't figure out what 4 times 8 is and you're in the 6th grade, your paper needs to be marked in red. But the rod, the correction, the reproof. The fact is, from my experience at Walmart and Cub, I don't know that anybody's even given reproof anymore. I mean, when Mom said, "No!" I knew I better quit. Or else I was going to get whacked, right? Now I hear moms whining, "No! No!" Listen. Your kid ain't listening to that. Your kid is not going to do what you want him to do in that tone of voice. You better have a tone of voice and a rod to back it up because this is not going to work this way. Now look, folks, I got some wisdom from Brother Williams at camp here a few years ago. I appreciate it very much. He said, you know, when you break it down, of course he's raised kids himself. And when I, you know, heard this, none of my kids were grown yet. But he said, you know, when you stop and think about it, you got really 3 stages of rearing your children. You have the controlling stage where from about 1, 2, depending on the age, 12, 13, 14, you are in the controlling stage. That is, when the 2-year-old wants to run into the road, wants to go hide in the freezer, well, you have to stop them whether they want to be stopped or not. At all costs, you are to stop them, right? I mean, if they're going to continue to throw soup all over the house whenever you put a bowl in front of them, you have to stop them. And it doesn't matter what they want. It doesn't matter their opinion. You're in control, or else you're supposed to be. But from 1 to somewhere in there, 12, 13, 14 years old, you're controlling them. And that's a stage where you spank them and where foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from them, right? I mean, I have twin granddaughters that are little and cute and all those sort of things. But mom knows what they're like sometimes, and a babysitter, they know what they're like sometimes. They're sinners. Look, your grandkids are sinners too. And your littlest, cutest little nephew, niece, whatever, is a little sinner. They have their own will, and their inclinations are always to stretch the limits and do what's wrong and to do what's not good for them. You say, well, I just don't believe that. Well, then you'll let them go kill themselves, because it's true. You're in control from 1 to 13. Then you need to beware, because somewhere around 12, 13, 14, through about 18, well, I'll use 18 because now, you know, in the States, here anyway, somebody is considered grown when they're 18. I'm not saying they are grown. I'm saying they're considered grown. I'm saying that the, you know, the state and the feds believe that they're grown then. Well, from 12 or 13 up to 18, you're pretty much in a correction stage where you can reprove them, but you can't make them do something. I mean, technically, if they're under my roof, they're going to do what else they do and all that kind of stuff. I know that's true. But by the time a boy gets 14 or 15 or 16, you're not going to have success throwing him around and throwing him over your knee and spanking him anymore. You're not going to be able to control every little thing that he does. Will you control some things? Yes, you will. But you're yielding that control. You're yielding that rule. And now you're correcting. Now, he's grown up, and hopefully, if you're wise, and sometimes teenagers' parents aren't very good at this, hopefully you're growing along with the teen, where you realize that you're now going to have to talk to him or her more and more as an adult, going to have to explain some things to them. It's not going to any longer be good to say, no, just because I say so. You're going to have to explain why someday, right? If the answer is no, when a kid is 14, there comes a time, and probably before that you need to explain why. Sometimes parents don't know why themselves. They just know that they don't want them to do that. That's not going to work for long. You're going to have to be able to communicate with your kid. If there's one thing that I saw in my personal life with my father, he didn't communicate with me. My dad was a great man. He was a good man, a patient man. And everybody knew he was, in many ways, an angel. Okay? But as far as talking to me, explaining things to me, I never got that. And so we didn't really have that much of a relationship after, you know, I got into high school. I was busy. I played 4 sports in high school. I was busy with sports all the time. Had a girlfriend late in high school. That wasn't a good idea, but I did. And, you know, so by the time I was in high school and then into college, Dad and I had a very superficial relationship, which is a bad thing because he died, you know, when I went off to Bible school. And so that was a bad thing. But that's the second stage. I mean, the correction stage, where that kid is growing up, you're going to have to learn to talk to him and reason with him. And you better have things in a situation where you can set them down and get their attention by appealing to their hearts. Now, if you've not done your work before and driving the foolishness from him, you're going to have a hard time. Okay? Everybody here knows there are teenagers around. I don't know that they're here. But everybody's run into a teenager somewhere that you can't talk to because the teenager has reared himself. He was left to himself. Right? Now, folks, by the time your kids grow up and they're 18 or 19, start getting out on their own. They have their own lives, their own jobs, perhaps their own car. One day, their own wife, husband, kids. You are then in an advisory role. You no longer correct. You no longer control. You're an advisor then. And that's where folks realize whether you've done your work or not. Because now, if your kid still respects you and the way you reared him or her from the time they were 1 to 12 or 13, and then from 13 up to 18, they'll come back around and their dad or their mom is their best friend, and they want to know what their mom or dad thinks about this decision they're going to make, or what do you think about this, dad, that kind of thing. I know parents that think they have the right to control their kids' lives after they're 18, 19, 20. I'm not drawing an exact line on these ages because I think they vary some, but you don't have the right to run your 25-year-old kid's life. I know moms who think that they still have a right to run their 30-year-old son's lives. You don't. You don't. And you're a fool to think so. And you're a fool to try to do so. Anyway, all that from just that. Verse 15. The rod of reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. The child left to himself. Again, not everybody has to be a homeschool mom, or, you know, there are sometimes situations that arise, but you cannot let your kids raise themselves. And God knows the TV can't raise them. But it will if you let it. Right? A child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. That child needs interaction from you. I can only emphasize multiple times how important it is for you to talk to your kids. Sure, there's an age, there's a time period where no should be sufficient. I should not have to explain to you why I say no or yes or do it or whatever. Don't ask me why, just go do it. But again, by the time they're 13, 14, 15, you need to explain some things, but you need to cultivate the ability to set them down and talk to them. Be involved in their lives, and it's not always that you should be preaching at them. I'm not saying that. Again, by the time they're 20, 22, 24, they may not take your preaching anymore if that's how you handle the relationship, right? Now, you better do this because rah, rah. No, wait a minute. No. There comes a time that they're adults, you're an adult, you should be able to talk. You should be able to communicate. That needs to start early in their lives. Okay? Yes, there's a time to say no, and no is the final word, and I don't have to tell you why. When you're 5, I don't have to explain why. When you're 15, sit down, son. I got some things to talk to you about. I need to tell you why. Right? Okay, back to verse 16. When the wicked are multiplied, transgression increaseth. Well, duh. But the righteous shall see their fall. You should take some comfort in the last half of that verse. The righteous shall see their fall. All else fails, you will see it from heaven or else from behind the Lord at the second coming. Right? You'll probably see some unrighteous, wicked folks fall in this life before it's all over with. But when the wicked are multiplied, transgression increaseth. That's how this works. When the body of Christ aren't witnesses and aren't the testimony they should be, then they let the proportions get in front of them. And they can never catch up. There was a day in America where not everybody is Christians, but there was the Bible influence. And nobody dared touch a woman that didn't want to be touched. Nobody dared beat up a woman or abuse a woman, because you'd wind up with your head hung from a tree somewhere, right? But that day's now long past. We now have fallen behind the curve. Now, I'm not saying, you know, I don't know exactly what the curve is, but when the wicked are multiplied, how's this go? When the wicked are multiplied, transgression increaseth. It just skyrockets because we lose our effect. We're now watching in America the invasion from the South, right? And the invasion of the Muslims. Folks, one day this country is going to be lost. I'm not saying it's going to be next year. I don't know when it's going to be, but it's getting spooky scary. There's some places you can go in Michigan where they've lost it. You go to Detroit, they've lost it. Okay, there is no longer a Bible influence. There is no longer a Christian influence. It is almost a foreign country. Okay, so bottom line, you've got to do what you can do. Yes, we are in some ways fighting a losing battle. We're probably not going to turn the country around. I don't think we will. I don't see folks loving the Bible enough. I don't think people are fearful enough of the God of heaven any longer to make the turn wholesale, right? But I can do what I can do. And I'll do all that I can do. It is still an honor to live in the last days. It's a very dark day, but it's easier today than ever for somebody that just will to be the salt of the earth and to be the light of the world. You can find somebody every day to talk to. Right? Back to verse 16. When the wicked are multiplied, transgression increaseth. I was always horrified. I was a country boy, a farm boy. And so that first year I was in Pensacola, to go to New Orleans to Mardi Gras to a street preach was like, whoa. Put on blinders, man. It was like, it was a shock. Well, now you can see that stuff in any town in America, just about, of any size. You see some of the same stuff I saw at Mardi Gras that I was horrified at. You can see it in downtown Minneapolis. You can go down on Friday night. No, don't do it. But you can go to some places on Friday night and see it every Friday night. When the wicked are multiplied, transgression increaseth. But the righteous shall see their fall. Correct thy son, and he shall give thee rest. Now that's what you want, right? You want a day where your son, your daughter, your kid, you no longer have to be on guard every moment to make sure that you keep the big bad wolf away, because he's capable of taking care of himself. He can give you rest because you've reared him well. He's got good judgment. He is strong. He's got his own faith. I'm not talking about a different faith than yours. He's got his own God, his own Savior, his own Bible. He can give you rest because now you don't have to worry about him all the time like when he was this high. Right? If you do things right. Verse 17. Correct thy son. He shall give thee rest. Yea, he shall give delight to thy soul. You have to tell them that they're wrong. You have to tell them no. And not just no for a little while until they wear you down. But no. No, we're not doing that. Right? Verse 18. Where there is no vision, the people perish, but he that keepeth the law, happy is he. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Now, that's always preached from the perspective of the vision being like the big goal, right? I mean, I have a vision for America, right? Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream. It was a nightmare, but it was a dream. Well, he was really talking about a vision, right? I mean, I have a vision for this happening. Okay, you're talking about goals there. I really honestly don't believe this is what this is talking about. where there is no vision, the people perish. Look in 1 Samuel 3. 1 Samuel 3. Little different slant on this. I think this is more biblical than what you tend to think when you kind of devotionalize the passage, which is the way we do it most times. Where there's no vision, the people perish. If you don't have a vision of hell, if you don't have a vision of heaven, if you don't have a vision of seeing your family get saved, then they probably won't. Where there's no vision, the people perish. That's how folks take it. And it's true. It's fine. But notice 1 Samuel 3. Let's make sure we keep this in context of what it actually says. The child Samuel ministered unto Eli, the Lord before Eli, and the word of the Lord was precious in those days. There was no open vision. Now, what's that mean? That means that until Samuel really came along and got grown, which was started pretty much after this passage we just read, there was no open vision in the sense that God did not give the prophets visions and words to tell the people. The people were backslidden and they were just coming out of Judges, and they had no vision because they didn't really have anything new the prophets were telling them. Right? Let me give you another example of this. Look in Isaiah 1:1. Over and over again, the prophets said that they had visions. And that's not talking about an Oral Roberts type vision, by the way, where you see what you want to see and pretend that it's real. But verse 1 of Isaiah 1, the vision of Isaiah the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Okay, Isaiah had a vision. Again, these prophets were spoken to by God in dreams and visions. Those dreams and visions were just as real as you opening up the book of Romans and reading it. Okay? And that's really what they were. So when it says in Proverbs 29:18, where there is no vision, the people perish, it's fine to devotionalize it to be, you know, I have a vision for the lost. I have a vision for heaven. I have a vision for hell. I have a vision for getting my family saved. That's fine. That's true. It's good. But technically speaking, where there's no vision, the people perish. But he that keepeth the law, happy is he. That's talking about that law being the vision. And failing that, that's the vision that the prophets received from God that they passed on. So we're talking about the prophets' prophecies. To us, we're talking about the Bible all the way. If you have a vision contrary to the Bible, it's not worth the dime that you spent to get it. Okay? That's the vision. Again, don't get me wrong. I'm saying it's fine to have the goal, the farsightedness, the vision of something righteous and good happening. That's true. I need a vision of Jesus Christ coming back in the judgment seat of Christ. I mean, that helps, right? But technically speaking, I get that from the Bible, because what this is talking about is the vision of a prophet, a distinct thing that Isaiah wrote, a distinct thing that eventually Samuel got, because in his day there was no open vision, right? The law, the Bible. Where there is no vision, the people perish, but he that keepeth, excuse me, the law, happy is he. A servant will not be corrected by words. That's an interesting statement there, huh? Well, how are you going to correct a servant then? Well, as against our grain as it is today, and rightfully so because we don't do that anymore, but in the Bible, the master had the right and prerogative to, in some measure, put out corporal punishment on a servant. Right? It says there that a servant will not be corrected with words, for though he understand, he will not answer. And the idea, I guess, being that most of those servants in the Old Testament, for instance, were not servants voluntarily. Right? I mean, think about being a slave. They're not necessarily voluntary servants. So when the master just talks at them and there's nothing issued beyond that, the servant may nod, and then as long as he's not corrected and controlled, he'll go do what he wants to do. Now, that may be distasteful to you. I'm sorry if that's the case, if we've come to the day where the culture we live in affects us so that we resent something written in the Bible. I'm really sorry, but that's the case. Now, look in verse 19 again. Look at it this way. A servant will be not be corrected by words, for though he understand, he will not answer. I'm a servant of God, right? And I'm supposed to be corrected by His words. Now, whom the Lord loveth, He chasteneth. Okay, so sometimes there's chastening. That's true. But there's another aspect to this. Go down just a few more verses. Let me see if I can find it. Verse 21. Notice an interesting addendum here. He that delicately bringeth up his servant from a child shall have him become his son at the length. See, the thing is, I am a servant of God because I got saved and God called me to serve Him. And He gave me His word and I'm supposed to go by that word. Now, the problem is, I find in myself the spirit of that servant who sometimes will not respond to just being talked to. The advantage that I have is I'm not just a servant. I've been delicately brought up, and I'm a son. And as a son, the word should be enough. Right? Verse 19, a servant will not be corrected by words, for though he understand, he will not answer. Seest thou a man that is hasty in his words? There is more hope of a fool than of him. And again, that goes back to verse 11. Verse 21, he that delicately bringeth up his servant from a child.